action.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Average Critics. I'm joined today by Obi and Chris. How are you both?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Hungry. How are you?
Good. Yep, good. I'm satiated, so Obi's going to get some dinner soon. We did record a pod on Sunday, but the audio was poor, so that will be lost in the ether.
Lost in the archive.
Maybe if this ever blows up, we can release it as like one of those, you know, collector's edition things.
I should have said more better stuff.
Well, I was getting the bleeper out, mate. So I'll kind of quickly cover off what we covered. That, you know, Werewolf by Night was fine. the special format was okay. Didn't really know when it was set. Quite liked the fact that Marvel were kind of going down the R route with it. It was probably the best format to do so. Chris, did you watch Werewolf by Night yet?
I watched some of it, but I did see the thing about the costume of Man-Thing was, what, like 90% prosthetic rather than CGI, which I thought was pretty cool, and probably should bring some of that back to modern-day cinema, really.
Yeah, it didn't look too bad. I mean, it helped it was black and white for most of it. But also, Jack Russell's werewolf looked practical as well. Which, you know, gives it an element of looking a bit tacky, but also...
Yeah, I thought it looked a bit cheap, personally.
Yeah.
Well, talking of the prosthetics and stuff, I did read something the other day that the filming of The Hobbit, Unexpected Journey, the first one, Ian McKellen got really upset because I think, again, like 90% of it was CGI. And he was like, I didn't become an actor to act like this. And, like, the next day they had to, like, cheer him up because he was, like, really downhearted about it all. So I thought that's quite interesting. So obviously it does take its toll on the actors as well.
I'm sure the millions of pounds they paid him to compensate for
it. Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
But Christian Bale said something similar about Thor Love and Thunder. He said he's never used so much green screen in his life. And it must be weird because you're not really interacting with your entire environment. And if you're kind of a classic actor like Ian McKellen is, or, you know, Christian Bale has been doing it for years and years, like, probably a bit odd. But yeah, so that was Werewolf by Night. I know I'm rattling through it. There was the news that Hugh Jackman is returning as Wolverine in Deadpool 3, which is due out on the, I think it's the 6th of September in 2024. So it was due to be just before Blade, but Blade is unlikely to meet its release date, which was due to be the 3rd of November 2024, because they're having production issues, the director's left. Slash Film reported today that Mahershala Ali is kind of overseeing some rewrites, or is involved in some rewrites, so yeah, won't be filming until at least early 2023, so that's probably going to get pushed back.
Wait, so he's doing the rewrites, or he's overseeing the person doing the rewrites?
The latter,
right,
is what I understand. I think he's sort of like wants to shape the story, and so we'll be kind of helping with the rewrites. But yeah, I mean, we were both quite excited about the Wolverine news. We didn't, just for the Lost Pod anyway. We thought that it was unlikely to tarnish the legacy of Logan, particularly as I think they explained it was Logan was set in 2029. This won't be set that late, and obviously you've got all the whole variants and things. We also spoke about whether we would be happy if John Krasinski was not Mr. Fantastic, and I quite strong on that. I didn't feel that Marvel were super fan servicey, and so if they weren't planning to cast him in the role full time, I don't really see why they would have done it for Doctor Strange 2. Any strong thoughts?
Apparently,
any of what I've just said?
Isn't he rumored to be in Deadpool 3 and also Tom Holland's Spider-Man?
I've not heard that. Is that relation to the tweet he did after?
Well, I don't know, because apparently lots of actors have done tweets in relation to it. So, I think, unless it's a hoax, Robert Downey Jr. changed his Twitter headline, didn't he? To say, I was Iron Man to I am Iron Man, and Captain America did the same thing.
Oh, I did not notice that. That passed me by, but that could be right. What do you think about Hugh Jackman returning?
I think I've got no issue with it. Logan was good, great, in fact, and it was a nice end. But in this universe of multi-universes and time travel, I think bringing him back is no issue to me. I think it's been a while since he was in something. Was it 5-6 years now? Maybe even longer. How long has it been since Logan?
Yeah, Logan was 2017, I believe. So by the time Deadpool 3 comes out, it'll be 7 years since he was...
Yeah. So, like, I think it'll be a nice way to try and introduce maybe X-Men and Deadpool to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think they need to pull in a roster of people in order to get good traction on Deadpool 3. Because although I think it did do well, Deadpool 2, I think a lot of people were a bit lost on the whole concept of it. And in order to bring it into this universe, there's, I guess, that an anchor, and that anchor would be Hugh Jackman, I guess. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think as long as they keep the tone the same, I'm not bothered about they continuing the kind of plot points that they did in the first two.
Do you guys think, do you guys think that, so if Hugh Jackman obviously is in this film, do you think he's going to be in the MCU as Wolverine going forward? Because I'd be surprised if they did that.
I can't imagine it, but yeah, I mean, it's weird because there's been so many X-Men in the last 20 years, as in like two very distinct age cohorts, and he has been the consistent across both. Obviously, once you got into Days of Future Past and that, there was both of them at the same time, but I feel like it's still a bit too early to recast everybody. And so maybe this is, like Chris said, a nice, easy way into those characters, a little bit of continuity, and then they can somehow explain, you know, a variant of. You know, it could be the assistant from She-Hulk. She's got her little makeup brushes as her three claws, as we saw in episode 8. So could be Ginger Gonzaga as Wolverine.
What's her name?
The actress is called Ginger Gonzaga. I don't know what the character's called.
Oh, fair enough.
The She-Hulk assistant, yeah. Right. So She-Hulk, where episode 7 was a thing. Episode 8 had Daredevil. He got busy with She-Hulk. She also got kind of... I don't know if they ever coined a term for it, but she got her personal info hacked and kind of displayed on the internet, which caused her some rage. And yeah, it leads into the last episode, which presumably she will have to find out who's behind Intelligentsia and is determined to steal her blood and take her down, which maybe is the leader. You said it could link into Cap 4.
Yeah, that's the rumour. Which I think would be interesting. And I suppose, because She-Hulk in particular has not been like, I think like the other shows, for the most part, have kind of been like, oh, how do they lend themselves towards Phase 4 or the rest of the MCU? I think She-Hulk hasn't really been that. So if they, it'd be interesting if they decide to do that now, that this all leads into Captain America. Or, well, so yeah, we still don't know what's going on with Hulk's been off-world since episode 2, I think, so. On if they mention that in the final episode at all.
Ah, well, I presume you haven't seen any promotional footage for episode 9.
Oh, no, I haven't, no.
I saw something starting and I turned it off quickly.
Fair. Yeah, do you want me to say or do you want to just wait?
I can wait.
Okay, fine. Yeah, so She-Hulk, that was the penultimate episode. It was nice being back in the company of Daredevil. I know they changed maybe the tone of him, but that was unsurprising considering the tone of She-Hulk. Nice to see that he got some more screen time, opposed to the fleeting cameo in Spider-Man No Way Home.
Mm.
Are we all up to date with House of Dragon?
I am.
I know everything that happens, so you can talk about it as much as you want.
Okay. So, episode 8 has just happened. We didn't talk about episode 7 because it's been 2 since we last podded. Another time jump. So, where are we now? Episode 7 was Driftmark. You've got Rhaenyra and Daemon reunite for the funeral of Laena, who is Daemon's deceased wife. The whole family are there. There's a lot of tension. There's a lot of, you know, there's rumblings on about the parentage of Rhaenyra's children. You know, on paper they're Lenor's, but Laenor, I should say it better. But they don't look like him. They look more like Lord Strong, who was disposed of at the end of episode 6. Rhaenyra and Daemon get busy. They orchestrate the apparent death of Laenor in order for them to marry. And Aemond, who is the brother of Rhaenyra, gets his eye cut out by one of her sons.
Half-brother. Yeah, this family dynamic is crazy.
It is crazy. I've been trying to figure it out, and it's baffling my mind a bit. But yeah, he gets...
I looked at a family tree, and it fucking confused the shit out of me.
Yeah, I think it's Luke or Lucerys that cuts it out. And so there's more tension. Alicent gets a bit hot-headed as she's like, well, I demand an eye from one of your kids then. And Rhaenyra's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Viserys is getting involved, trying to shut it down. But, you know, tension remains. And then episode 8 is 6 years after that as well. So I've been trying to figure out how long it's been since episode 1. I think it's around 20-odd years.
Okay, just see, I'm glad you said that. So let's say it's 20 years. I read a thing today, and this is just a passing point. So actually 2 points. First point, no one else in this, apart from the children, no one has aged at all. Daemon looks exactly the same as episode 1. So Chris looks exactly the same as episode 1. The only person who's aged as an adult is Viserys, and he looks fucking 97,000 years old. My second point is that, Viserys apparently, I don't know what, disease he's contracted or whatever happened to him.
Leprosy.
I guess, is it leprosy? Okay. I guess that makes you look like super old because he's 52 when he dies, apparently. And,
yeah.
So that would have meant at the start of the series, he was 32 and he did not look 32 at all. But anyway, and if he was 32, how old was Rhaenyra? Anyway, sorry, continue.
Yeah, it's all been a bit, there's a lot of suspension of disbelief when it comes to the ages of these people. And you kind of have to just look at the kids and be like, okay, so this is approximately how many years have passed.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's weird that they haven't aged anyone else.
Yeah.
Considering, it doesn't help that they've all got white hair though. So like someone like Corlys or Viserys, they looked like they were in their 40s when episode 1 happened. And so I was thinking that they would be at least in their 60s. But, so episode 8, Corlys has been fighting in the Stepstones for 6 years and has apparently got a wound that might end his life. So then there's the whole issue of succession. Mm. His brother, I think it's called Vaemond, is saying that as he's the last full-blooded Velaryon, then he should take over being the king of the Driftwood Chair, whatever it's called. But Rhaenys, who's Corlys's wife, sort of saying maybe she could do it. And also there's, you know, the succession of Viserys Targaryen, who, you know, is a bastard that we know, but everyone's assuming that, just pretending it's not. So they go to, what do they call it?
Westeros?
What's the capital called? My mind's just gone blank. King's Landing.
King's Landing.
They go to King's Landing, and in the interim time, Viserys has got very sick. He's now basically the Phantom of the Opera, and Alicent and her father, the Hand, Otto Hightower, are basically running it by proxy.
Otto is exactly the same as well, by the way.
I know. Whatever anti-aging cream they're using is working.
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
Do you know, someone like L'Oreal should run a campaign and be like, use our cream because you can not age in 20 years. But yeah, so they're basically going to decide the succession, which is heavily weighted against Rhaenyra because of all the politics, although Viserys comes hobbling in after Rhaenyra visited him the night before and basically said, you know, I want you to back me up. He comes in, sits on the chair, says to Vaemond, you know, this is already decided. Why are you even coming to me with this petition? Says it's the Lucerises. Rhaenys backs him up. Vaemond turns around and says, you lot are bastards and your mum's a whore. And then Vaemond fucking slices his head in half, which was a complete shock. And yeah, there are basically no more Velaryons. There are half Velaryons with Daemon's daughters. Bela and I don't know what the other one's called. Rhaena? I don't know. But yeah, so he gets chopped in half, and then there's a family dinner where everyone sarcastically toasts one another. And
did you think it was sarcastic?
Yeah. Wow, it's like, I don't know, passive aggressive is probably the best way of saying it.
I thought Rhaenyra. I thought Rhaenyra's and Alicent's were sincere.
Yeah, I think they were sincere, but then the kids were like,
oh yeah, the kids for sure. Yeah, they were taking the mic.
And we find out that Aegon is married to his sister, Helaena, I think her name is. She's a bit away with the fairies, a bit Luna Lovegood.
I was just thinking that the same thing, Luna Lovegood.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And then it ends with Viserys basically, with his last breath, thinks he's talking to Rhaenyra, but is actually talking to Alicent. So Rhaenyra, previously in the episode, had asked him if he truly believes in the Song of Ice and Fire and the Prince that's promised. And he says yes, and mentions that, you know, she knows what she has to do, and mentions Aegon. So Aegon could be Aegon the Conqueror, could be his son Aegon, or his grandson Aegon. So Rhaenyra's got a kid called Aegon. Or it could also refer to Jon Snow, 200 years later, who is revealed to be an Aegon. But Alicent takes this as, like, okay, wink, wink, you know what I need to do. And then it ends with Viserys' passing. So it's going to cause some fracas between the dragons, Targaryens. I think the last two episodes particularly have reaffirmed to me what I think this series' strength is, and that's in the family dynamics. So I've had not a tough time reconciling it, but it's been so different to Game of Thrones in that you're not getting the breadth of the continent and lots of politicking. You're getting it just contained within one family, and sometimes not actually a lot that happens, but the kind of interplay between all the characters is fascinating, and how they scheme. It's kind of like Succession, if you've ever seen Succession, the HBO show, a bit like that. So I'm really enjoying it, and I mean, I'm forgiving the time jumps, which are quite annoying, particularly as you struggle to orient who's who. Some of the characters look older than their older brothers. Aemond, for example, has shot up and is now taller than Aegon, but is a couple of years younger, I think. So yeah, I mean, Chris, I don't know how much you've watched, but how are you finding it, or have you kind of lost interest?
I've not watched enough to give a impactful response, but I've watched maybe two episodes, so It's an interesting series. It's just that I've just prioritised other ones over it. But it seems like a good introduction to this story, I guess. But I don't know how long.
Spoiled it for you.
Honestly, when you talk about something that I know I'm going to watch, I zone out for that part, so it's fine. But yeah, I don't know how long they can keep this season on for, but I guess you guys would know a bit better. I just feel like the time jump when it's meant to come is maybe quite soon in a series, but yeah.
Well, Obi, you've particularly struggled with the time jumps, so I don't know if there are any more on the cards, but presumably can't be too many more, as most of them are now adults. Like, how have you found the last two episodes?
The last two episodes, I've enjoyed, to be fair. Especially episode 8, I thought was really strong. I think I was saying, I don't know if we recorded this, but I was saying episode 7, I thought the back half was really strong, but the first maybe 15, 20, it was really like slow and it was a bit off, it was a bit strange, I thought. But it picked up later on and I thought it got a lot better. The time jumps, I mean, I have said multiple times that I don't love them. I like giving characters time to breathe and we can see like the finer details of chemistry and, you know, connections between certain people that are allowed to like develop properly. And we can find out why, and we can truly know why characters do the things, make decisions they make and do the things they do. And obviously this, like I've said, is a more micro version of Game of Thrones, so that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it takes some getting used to. I suppose I would say I've gotten used to it now, I guess, because this is what, the fourth time jump, I think, maybe, in eight odd episodes. So I guess it is what it is at this point. But yeah, things like Rhaenyra and Daemon already having two kids with a third on the way, and you know, one of Daemon's daughters, I think, staying with them in Dragonstone, I think, and the other one staying in Driftmark. Is it Driftmark? The Valyrians. Stuff like that, I think, would involve like finer character details that, you know, reasonings for why those decisions are made, and those are things that I think could be interesting to see play out, but we don't get those. It kind of just skips over stuff like that. And even like Aegon, Alicent's Aegon marrying his sister, stuff like that, like I think could have, you know, done with some fleshing out. Does he want to marry her? Does she want to marry him? She's like you said, she's in the way of the fairies, like what's her deal? Like we've barely got any of her apart from the odd throwaway line of something weird or her looking at bugs or something.
Yeah, well, that apparently she said something and it kind of led, it was a prophecy. So it, she said something about losing an eye, and then later that day her brother loses an eye.
All right.
But like you said, that there's so many of these characters that are just underutilized. Mm. And it's the worst part of the show, because like you said, you're not getting the same level of detail with all the characters. I mean, Daemon's got two kids who have maybe had like 10 lines between them. Mm. Helena, yeah, we don't know what's up with her. I mean, even people like Lena, Daemon's deceased wife, she was in it as an adult for one episode and then burned alive. That you're not getting enough time to care about a lot of these characters, and they're just treating them like, I don't know if you used the term, Obi, before, but cannon fodder, which is a shame, because we're quite used to most characters getting quite a rich level of detail. I mean, even in the Game of Thrones series, all of like, you know, a couple of the whores of the people that are in the pleasure place with Littlefinger, like they would have, you know, semi-developed storylines.
Mm.
And now you're getting major characters who barely in it. Like, what would you say is Corlys's motivation beyond just having his family line, the name extended? Like, he doesn't really say much else other than that, and yet again they're fighting a third war in the Stepstones, which we've barely had any action in. It's just strange to me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, to be fair. And not to bash the show, because I enjoy the show a lot, like a lot, but yeah, it's things like, and I get it's tough not to compare it to Game of Thrones. Sometimes you have to. Like, Game of Thrones, for me, is one of like the best shows I've ever watched. So, naturally, if they bring out a sequel to it, I'm going to compare one to the other. But yeah, I don't want to talk at all about the stuff that I didn't like, but also stuff I did like. I thought this episode 8 was really strong. I thought, is its name Paddy Considine?
Yep.
Yeah. I thought he was really good, and I think has been pretty good in since he basically became a cripple and like a, you know, the leprosy got him good. He's acted out really well, I feel like. This episode especially, kind of on his last legs pretty much. I thought that the scene with, so there's a few scenes that stood out for me that I thought were really cool. So the first one was Aemond, when the two, Rhaenyra's two sons come along and they're watching him like joust with Ser Criston. And he's basically obviously showing you that he's very, very capable with a sword, even though he's only got one eye. And then, like, without kind of like breaking eye contact, he says, "Oh, nephews, you're here. Are you here to train?" And like, yeah. I like that actor. I think there's something about that actor's face, those facial expressions, that make me think, yeah, you're gonna be sick. Like, either evilly or either good or bad, as in character wise, you're gonna be a sick character. I think he showed that in this episode. So yeah, I enjoyed his character a lot. There was also the throne scene, which I thought was really strong. I thought the music at this point as well was really, really on point, especially when Rhaenyra was about to say her piece and her dad walks in and he's just like, and like, it's funny because like he takes a really, really long time to get from the door to the throne, but they just let it like play out as it would.
Yeah, it's kind of agonizing, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, because he sees he's in pain, he's struggling, and then he says to Hightower, "I'll take the throne today," and he's like, "Yeah, my king," and then he's like, "Walk," and also Hightower's getting a bit, I don't like how he was sitting on that throne, he was getting a bit too comfortable.
Yeah.
And then I'll go on to talk about Hightower in a minute, actually, but then, yeah, so when the king's, like, when he drops his crown, and then Daemon's there to just pick it up, and he's like, whispers like, "Come on," like, and he's like, you can tell obviously those first few episodes there was so much animosity between the two, but deep down he does like care for his brother, and vice versa, and it kind of like shows me of that thing in, I think it was episode 2, when Corlys is talking about the king, and basically Daemon's like, "Yeah, I can talk shit about my brother, but you can't, like, relax." Mm-hmm. And it just reminds you that those two, he does like value that relationship. And even when they first go to visit the king and he's like on his deathbed and stuff, like Daemon can barely look at him when he's like explaining about why they're here. He's like looking up and down, like he literally can't stare him in the eyes, because like, I assume because he can't like bear to see his brother like that, like basically on his deathbed. So I thought that was really well acted.
Daemon's been so complex, hasn't he? He's like flipped between being like a real villain and then not necessarily a hero, but just he's very complex and. Yeah. He doesn't get a lot to say or do, really, but he does it really well. Like, you could tell when he cut off Vaemond's head, like, Aemond was, like, looking at him kind of with pride.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's kind of like, oh, damn.
Absolutely. He wants to be him. You could tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, he absolutely wants to be him. And even then, just before he cuts off Vaemond's head, oh, it's so annoying. I haven't got loads of time. I really want to get into this episode. It's annoying. Even before he cuts off Vaemond's head, when Vaemond's about to say, like, call him bastards, he's like, say it. Like, he wants to chop off his head. He's like, yeah, go on,
yeah.
Say it. I thought that was jokes. And obviously he did it. And I do like how, like, because I was a bit, I'm not as skeptical now, but I was very skeptical in last episode when them two decided to hatch this plan and get together, because I thought maybe Daemon is going to snake her. And I suppose he still might, but this episode makes me believe a bit more that he's riding for Rhaenyra kind of thing. Not that I even like Rhaenyra that much, because she's a bit of a, I don't know, she's a bit wayward as well, but, you know, I like seeing, you know, two people who, you know, were willing to, you know, die for each other. Not die for each other, but, you know, strong partnership kind of thing. And yeah, last thing I'm going to say is that, so we can maybe talk about She-Hulk or something, so we can all get involved in the conversation. The fact that this civil war is going to start on a technicality, because we don't know which egg on your referring to, is dumb as hell. But fuck it, why not? Excuse my language.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it would have naturally kicked off anyway, but yeah, they've kind of fudged it, just made it a bit quicker. I'm wondering if you guys are both up to speed with Rings of Power, if you want to kind of pivot from one fantasy to another. Chris, are you up to date?
Yeah, I've seen the majority of the latest episode.
I have not seen the latest episode. I've seen episode 6, not episode 7.
Do you guys want to talk about where we're up to now and where Gimli's at and Treebeard and that?
I hope you can start us off because I don't want to spoil anything that he hasn't seen.
Fairs. So I think last I spoke about it was when maybe the first two episodes come out. And we were basically following like four groups of people. The elves, like Galadriel and them lot. And they went to like Numenor and stuff. And then we had the, what's Gimli again? Gimli a dwarf.
Yeah, I think Gimli's from Lord of the Rings. Yeah. That's just being...
But no, yeah, I mean his people, because I can't remember what the dwarf is called. But yeah, so then you've got the dwarves and Elrond and their beef. Then we've got the Harfoots, which are basically like hobbits, but not. And then we've got the regular folk with one elf, Arondir. So the episode 7... pretty much. So I think throughout this series, we've basically been building up to Galadriel managing to convince the Queen of Numenor that she needs an army to fight off Morgoth, who is going to resurface in the Southlands. So she lets them sail towards the Southlands. Meanwhile, in the Southlands, Arondir was in a slave camp for one episode. I thought that was a really cool episode. And then the head of the orcs, Adar, I believe is his name, lets him go and basically says, go warn your people, we're coming, we're going to kill everybody unless they all surrender. So then he goes back to those town people and basically says, yeah, these are coming to kill us. The town people run away to kind of like take shelter and prepare for the attack coming. A few of them break off because they're like, we might as well just join Morgoth and them lot because we're toast. So some of them break off. And they want to get this weapon. I don't know what exactly it is, but it's some sort of weapon, I think, from this kid called Theo who found it in a barn, which basically is like super powerful and brings about the... is it the eruption of Mount Doom, I believe? So then episode 6, which is the last episode I saw, which basically just a full-out battle. So it was the elves... Not the elves, sorry. It was the orcs coming to attack the townspeople, and they basically hatched a plan to trap them in this castle, and basically they all think, they being the townspeople and Arondir, they all think that they've kind of like stopped that wave of attacks, and then there's another wave coming, so then they go and fend off another wave of attacks. Lo and behold, they win, inverted commas, but then they kind of take off some of the all the orcs had masks on, well, some of them had masks on, they take them off and find that they were actually real people, and people who the orc took prisoner, and somehow, I don't know how, but somehow managed to get them to battle. So they killed their own people, basically. That was a little twist. It was kind of deep. And this weapon that the orcs are after, Arondir hid. But then the orcs somehow managed to escape the trap that was set for them earlier. And they basically come, kill their people, and the Adar threatens to kill Bronwyn, which is Theo's mum, and because of that, Theo tells them where this weapon is. So then they get the weapon, they're about to sail off, but then just as they're about to sail off, Galadriel and all the Numenir warriors, they all come through, save the day, start murking everyone, and Galadriel is like fuming with this Adar geezer, because Adar's like half elf, I think, or at least a former elf. So that I think she feels like betrayed by him and stuff. So she was about to kill him, but then she's convinced not to. And then they capture Adar, presumably to like find out what his ultimate plan is. And then they manage to regain the weapon that Adar had stolen. But then when Theo's told to go and destroy it or hide it or whatever. Theo, like, unravels the weapon, and it's not the weapon they thought it was. Turns out this old geezer who betrayed all the townspeople has the weapon. He uses it, digs it into the ground, twists it or something like that, and basically Mount Doom erupts and volcano erupting, water flooding everywhere, and like bear people dying and stuff. So that was where we left episode 6.
That sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
Not that I really remember much of any Lord of the Rings, but yeah, Chris, how's it kind of progressing? I think the first two episodes you kind of felt was a bit slow. Is it ramping up now?
No, well, yeah, I thought the first two episodes were slow, but I expect it to be. But I've actually really enjoyed this whole series so far. I think the episode Ovi's talking about was the most action-packed, so I think it's more enticing for a lot of people. And I really enjoyed that episode. I think the twist of the people being within the armor rather than the orcs themselves was unexpected but unexpected. I knew there was going to be a twist, I just didn't know it was going to be that. And I think it was indicated prior to us seeing them come storming in that the humans that were captured were going to turn on their own people, because they were fighting, they'd been given the task of fighting each other in order to join Adar. And I also believe Adar is a evil or fallen elf. And there's like a whole backstory towards that, which they may or may not divulge into. But yeah, it was really interesting. I think there's points of it where I'm a bit like, how did that happen? For example, how did the... Because basically, the weapon that Ovi was talking about was actually in the possession of another person within the human people. He had it and the kid took it. And basically they then the guy who originally had it managed to steal it from where it was hidden. I assume, well, this is how I assume it happened. And then put it and make Mount, make, was it, what did Ovi say it made? Mount Doom.
Yeah.
And the visuals of it, like this whole series, the visuals have been like so, so good. Like, I mean, expected when they're spending, well, I found out the other day they spent $250 million on the rights to the appendices. And so I assume the other $750 million is going to be spread over 5 seasons. So the visuals have just been on point for all of it. I don't really care in the series about the, I can't remember what they're called, the hobbits, but the hobbits right now, they're a bit,
the Harfoots
right now, they're just a bit.
That's the general consensus amongst people.
And from reading, so a lot of people believe there's an old man with him, Glenn, who's fallen from the sky or fallen from a star. And a lot of people believe that to be Gandalf, but if that's the case, then timings are really off. Like, Gandalf is old, but I don't think the timings match, so I'm not sure that is Gandalf. It might be. It's the only person that makes sense from what we know. The dwarf situation with the elves, that's somewhat interesting, somewhat political in its own right, but still yet to really take off in that department. So the key area is obviously Numenor, this great battle, identifying these different people. And I think as a series as a whole, I think it's really good. And I think its only downfall is the fact that it's come out of the exact same as House of Dragon. And I think because House of Dragon, like from what you guys talk about or other people talking about, it's quite graphic and quite action-packed for good chunks of it. Whereas this has been a bit, obviously, like a slower start, so...
It's way faster pace, yeah.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people, like, really like that fast pace, and obviously they're doing comparisons when, in reality, although they're the same sort of genre, they are completely different in their own right, in the sense that one has one mythical beast, whereas the other has several different mythical or made-up characters, like...
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? So, but it's really good. I'd recommend it to most people. And I think for me, because I'm not like a diehard, hardcore Lord of the Rings fan, but I do like the films, I think for me, attaching different names when I hear them or learning a bit more about the lore, I really like it. Whereas like a diehard fan might think, oh, that's not right. That's not right. Whereas a person who doesn't know any of it might just be a bit like, what the fuck is going on? So excuse my language, sorry. But yeah, I think it's really good.
And so do you think, does it seem like most of the locations are kind of real, or do you reckon a lot of it's CGI and it's just really good?
I personally think a lot of it's CGI and it's really good.
Because obviously Lord of the Rings was quite practical in a lot of senses, wasn't it?
Yeah, so Lord of the Rings is like, because you can even do a tour of Lord of the Rings right now in New Zealand, where it's like, you do a 2-week tour of like 10 different places. So yeah, they were very much so practical. But yeah, I don't know actually, that's an interesting question. Again, with today's modern technology, I assume most of it's CGI, but maybe like where they had the fight with the in the latest episode, that might have been in a real location, potentially.
I wonder if also, are you going to get quite a long time between series? Because, you know, this took a long time to come to fruition. And if the visual effects are, you know, really impressive, then presumably they're not going to rush it out to come out next year.
So I did read something that they had to maybe it was about something else, but I'm sure they were filming parts of it at the same time. I'm not sure. But you'd like to think that this would be the top of their like to-do list. But then I guess like from what I heard the other day, Invincibles, and that's only an animated series, that's in a back catalogue of other animated series that have got to be produced at the moment because there's such a understaffed animations industry.
I forgot about Invincible.
Yeah, apparently they've put forward season 2 and they've already written season 3, so yeah.
Okay. Well, I know that some of the Marvel, you know, VFX people came out and said, "Stop announcing projects. We don't have capacity to do this."
But then I would argue, why don't they just fund an expansion? You know, I'm sure there's so many people out there who have got a very good artistic vision who would love an animation job at one of these high-end places. Why not just expand their area, buy some land, build some buildings, hire some people? You know. I mean, I assume that, especially in the UK, there's a lot more buildings up for rent these days because of working from home. I assume that's the same in a lot of countries. So there must be areas they can hire out. So then,
yeah, but animation. But Disney would kind of hire in these people as contractors rather than. So like, if you're given, you know, 8 months' work on Secret Wars to do the VFX, like. You'd probably have to fund that expansion yourself, and then if for whatever reason Disney decide not to go with you for the next one, then you know you've got a huge overhead. I kind of maybe need to go back to the whole vertical integration thing, which was happening back in the golden age of Hollywood, where studios owned everything, cinemas, the production houses, and stuff. But it's interesting. Have you been watching Andor, Chris?
Do you know what? I have not got around to watching Andor, but please feel free to talk about it. Although I assume Obi's watched it and he's probably not got a lot of time to talk about it himself.
I've got a few minutes.
No. Yeah, go for it. Talk about it. I'll listen and ask some questions if I have any.
I'll kind of maybe just do a quick overview. We've already 5 episodes in, but...
How many episodes is it meant to be?
It's been...
12.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's been recruited by Stellan Skarsgård. Can't remember his character's name.
Luther.
That's it. Thank you. To help smuggle some payroll credits out of like an imperial base. So he's under a fake name, Clem, with the crew to basically infiltrate this base, steal the credits. Or I don't know if they've explained the purpose, but to basically just fuck them over. We've got Mon Mothma, who is a senator. She's kind of working with him as well. So we're kind of just laying the groundwork for like the rebellion, and it's quite slow, which is fine. there's a lot of character work. We've seen in the first couple of episodes, you saw some of Cassian's home planet, which was kind of like colonized, I think was kind of the vibe I was getting from it. Their kind of indigenous people were wiped out, and he was taken in by a family. I don't know any of the planets or any of it, so I can't be too eloquent with it all. But yeah, it's a slow pace. It looks good. A lot of it looks like it's filmed on location, and it's kind of just like a political drama at the moment, which is quite nice. I mean, Star Wars, I guess, is always inherently a political drama, but with lasers, and this kind of stripped that side of it away quite a lot. To just focus on building up the foundations of the rebellion. Is that fair assessment of it, Obi?
Yeah, I think that's a good assessment. I think that this series is a nice change of pace from the Star Wars we've gotten used to. So this is more like grounded, boots on the ground, like kind of a thing of like all this stuff that's going on with the lightsabers, spaceships and stuff like that. What's actually happening on the ground? How is it affecting the people kind of like who it would affect the most probably. So I'm enjoying it in that respect. I think it's definitely more character focused, which again, I don't mind. I get to learn more about Andor, for example. He obviously in Rogue One, Andor is like, oh, I've been in this fight since I was 6 years old. Everything I did for the rebellion, X, Y, Z. You get to this one and like Luthen kind of calls him out on his bullshit. Like he says, oh yeah, I was fighting for 3 years in the war when I was 16. And then Luthen's like, you were there for 6 months and you were a cook. It's like, well, so it turns out like he's not as, at least not at the beginning of this series, he's not as diehard as, you know, he is at the start of Rogue One. So like it's room for his kind of character to develop. Even now he's being paid. He's a mercenary. He's being paid to help out with this rebellion. He doesn't really give a shit either way, it seems. Well, he does give a shit, but he doesn't seem that bothered about the cause. So it's funny that he kind of like has run into this group of characters who, for one reason or another, do really believe in his cause. You've got, I can't remember his name, but the kid from, what's that show called?
End of the Fucking World.
Thank you. That kid, who's got this manifesto. And he's like a political, like he believes in, he had some bars. I can't remember what he was saying, but he was talking about, repression and stuff like that. He had a good few speeches, in the last episode.
Yeah, that was a really good line and I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah, I can't remember it at all. Oh, it's a shame. But, yeah, so like you can tell that kid's dying, by the way, 100 million% he's dying.
yeah.
Cause they've set him up to kind of like be a, not a martyr, but like kind of, I think, Cassian will take his manifesto and kind of like start to believe in the cause, and that will kind of like spur him on to be the rebel that he is in Rogue One. And obviously you've got, characters as like, I think, I want to say his name is Skeen, but I could be completely wrong, but, his brother, killed himself because the Empire kind of like took everything he had. So that's his reason for joining the rebellion. You've got these characters who, like I said earlier, for one reason or another, kind of believe in this overarching cause and kind of what they can do to fuck up the establishment, I guess. And Cassian, I imagine, is not there yet, and even admits to them that I'm only here for the money. But I'm curious to see kind of how that develops over time. So yeah, I'm enjoying that aspect of it a lot, for sure. Yeah. The Empire side of it, I find interesting, because it just seems everyone's, I mean, I suppose it makes sense, but everyone in the Empire side of it is just out to get that little bit more power that they can get, like, get promotion, or you want to be the one to stand out. And it's just, I think it's, even though it's, to us, that was one of the main themes of Rogue One as well, with, I believe his name's Krennic. He wanted to get credit for whatever it is Galen Erso was building, the Death Star, sorry. He wanted to get credit for that over, was it over Tarkin? Over someone, basically. And that was kind of like his greed, kind of, and his need to be noticed, and his need for, and his search for power kind of got the better of him. He ended up dying. I think similar things might happen to everyone involved in the Empire. And I think it's called... No, I was going to say it's called IBS. No, I think it's called ISB, not IBS. that whole thing. and I think there's a character called Cyril, I believe is his name. He's the one who's a bit uppity at the beginning and is a bit of a job's worth. And I think he's going to kind of like get consumed by that thirst for power as well. So I'm curious to see how that plays out as well. So I think there's some interesting dynamics going on in this show, which I'm enjoying. And yeah, I think it's definitely not, paced the way I thought it was going to be paced, but I'm enjoying it nonetheless, I think, the way it is paced. And I'm really sorry, I have to go. So I'll see you guys later.
The trailer made it seem a bit more action-packed, fast-paced than it's been, but that's fine. The character development on both sides is interesting. You get in these like character moments, like, you know, just a guard going on his cigarette break type thing. You know, it's just like you wouldn't get that in a normal Star Wars film. So, like Obi said, it's a good change of pace. And it looks good as well. Like it has that gritty feel to it.
Is it a spy thriller? Because I heard it was dubbed as like a spy thriller. So would you say it is that, or is it not quite the genre it claimed to have been?
I guess there's elements of espionage because they are like putting a plan together to steal information. But we're not really in the action of it yet. So they're still formulating their group, planning out what they're going to do. I always think of spies like, you know, your Jack Reachers, your James Bonds. It's not in that vein. It's more stealthy, a bit more.
Okay.
Like, I guess it kind of reminds me of a bit of a heist. Kind of like a heist, but there is elements of spy as well, because essentially they're trying to steal credits or money from the Empire. Check it out when you get a chance.
Yeah, well, to be fair, honestly, I'll be honest, I totally forgot it was even out, and that's my bad. That's my bad, totally. So I will make that my next priority, because I prioritised Karate Kid, but I won't talk about that until Obi's back, because I know he's a diehard Karate Kid fan.
Oh, yeah, season 5, is it?
Season 5 should probably stop sometime soon, but I'm sure they'll keep going until it's run dry. Yeah. Pardon me, sorry.
Are you up to date with She-Hulk?
I believe I'm up to date with She-Hulk. Is that the one with the Daredevil one, yeah?
Yeah. What have you thought about? I mean, we've only got one episode left. What are your general feelings about it?
Where to start and where to go without absolutely ruining it?
Just ruin it. If that's your genuine opinion.
I like the premise of it. I think it's a good character to divulge into. I think maybe it's trying to be a bit too comedic at times. I'm not really laughing much. I didn't think it would hone in so much about her date in life, because I feel like we've had the last 3 or 4 episodes kind of centralized around that somewhat. But it's not a big deal. There's plenty of series that do that, and it kind of works well. Like, you kind of feel her emotion through it, because obviously in the first one where she's going on many a date and all these people are just either assholes or arrogant or just want to cut her to see if she can bleed, like really weird. Like, it's just the weirdness of dating, but on a scale of human and She-Hulk. And then obviously we've got the whole aspect where she's at a wedding and she's got to be like her normal Gen self, which nothing wrong with that, but she's obviously seen the bright side of She-Hulk. And then you go to this other part where it's like, she just says, F it, and then her and Daredevil get it on. But there's nothing wrong with it. Just It's just I didn't think it would go that avenue, basically. I thought it would be more about the cases and more about her becoming more adaptable to her her strengths as She-Hulk. Kind of like this latest episode, where I think they did hone in on what's good about She-Hulk, where and to kind of take the mick a little bit out of Daredevil and how he has to go about kicking the butts of all these bad guys, and his fight scenes can take 5 minutes, whereas She-Hulk's one takes all of a matter of seconds because she can wipe out all these people within one clap of a hand, you know what I mean? So it was an interesting take. I didn't quite like the costume they used for Daredevil. I'm pretty sure it is a comic accurate costume from a series, but it wasn't my favourite, but it's cool nonetheless to see a different variation of our character that we like. I think he was very good. I think he did his own flair as a lawyer, and it worked very well. I think the bad guy of the episode was weird. I mean, but there are many weird bad guys throughout the whole of the history of superheroes, and it's interesting to see these other characters. Kind of like when Deadman? I don't know what he's called, but when he came into the episode, I think they tried to make him or his situation more funny, where if they just, they could have delved into him a bit more, and you would have seen how sad his life was. Was it Deadman? The guy kept killing himself and getting out of the marriages.
Oh, Mr. Immortal.
Mr. Immortal, that's it. Deadman's a DC. He's got quite a sad backstory, but obviously this is a light-hearted series, or tries to be, so I didn't think they would bring that in, but it's interesting. Obviously, I like the whole idea that her best mate could be some kind of witch, because of obviously her earrings, same as Agatha's necklace. She broke the fourth wall. She-Hulk breaks the fourth wall. I felt really sorry for She-Hulk at the end. I actually felt some empathy for her because of the way her sex life was just shown on TV, and I thought that was really it's really impactful for someone. And obviously, as you get through the series, you think She-Hulk's got the thick skin of it, but really, realistically, if She-Hulk gets mad, she's the most dangerous woman in the room, you know? So that was interesting. And
I was going to say, it's kind of like feminist commentary, because remember years ago when people like Jennifer Lawrence got all their iClouds hacked and stuff, and it kind of reminded me of that. It's like a prominent female celebrity, which is essentially what She-Hulk is. It's kind of the only way they can take her down is to kind of expose her private life in like a really demeaning way. And She-Hulk hasn't shied away from any of the kind of issues that Jen, as Jen or as She-Hulk, is going through, being a woman who's a superhero and a lawyer and, you know, this and that, which I think is to its credit, because that's the kind of the more serious side of it, but obviously it's got a very light tone throughout it. I kind of like they're just sprinkling in all these characters that you would never really, they're not going to be in the Avengers, are they? So you know, you're not going to see Leapfrog or Mr. Immortal, but I don't know, that episode 7 with Man-Ball and El Aguilar, Porcupine and all of them, I just thought it was a bit,
yeah,
that was just a bit too silly.
I was quite interested with the way they tried to tackle She-Hulk at the end, not tackle, but they surrounded her with them guns. I was just trying to think what guns are these? Are they them Sonic? Is it like the Sonic rays they had in the original Hulk movie that they were going to use on her? Because I don't really understand how they thought they were going to battle her.
Huh.
And it's kind of interesting that they had that kind of security at the event, even though they were honouring She-Hulk, weren't they?
Yeah, super lawyer of the year or something. But yes, so they were the Department of Damage Control, who have been popping up throughout Phase 4. So they're in Ms. Marvel and Spider-Man as well. So yeah, I don't know what sort of guns they had, but like you said, it could be kind of harking back to things like the Hulk.
Yeah.
Have we both seen the thing about episode 9 then?
Say it, and I probably have, because I'm pretty sure I watched, or you said you've watched.
Yeah, I just saw a still of Hulk fighting Abomination again.
Okay, yeah, I think I saw that. I think that's the thing I saw.
Like a rematch, which is intriguing. Because like Obi said, Hulk's been off-world for the last few episodes.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Like, what I've enjoyed most about this has been the legal side of it. Like, and when she was battling off against Matt Murdock in the courtroom, that's some of the best parts of the series because it shows her intelligence and like, I just find series like that, you know, Suits or whatever, when they use the law to kind of get one over on each other, I find it really satisfying. I don't know whether it's accurate or not, but it just sounds good.
I don't want to take away from the other aspects of it. It's just what I was trying to like get at is that I wasn't expecting it to be quite like that. If that makes sense. I hope I didn't like slander it. Like, it's just I expected it to be more law based, like 80-90% of the time law. Just especially the way they rushed through everything in the first episode with her just being able to come to terms with her powers, which actually in a roundabout way shows that she hadn't come to terms with her powers properly because she hadn't really got angry about something that meant a lot to her. And obviously in that last episode, that's going to mean a lot to 95% of people that's been released. So it's very heart-wrenching that happened kind of thing. And it's almost like heart-stopping. It's a heart-stopping moment because if that happened to me, I'd be like, oh my God, like, what the hell's going on kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, and the first, like, three or four episodes was very much legal-based, wasn't it? She would basically just have a different client and that would be the focus of the episode. And we've kind of slowly been more focusing on, like you said, her dating history or her working on herself. Now this whole intelligentsia thing, which has kind of just been tacked on. And, you know, I hope that whoever's behind it is someone we've seen before, because if it's someone new, you're going to have loads of questions and they're not going to answer them.
Well, they're really hinting at it, that being that guy who wants the... what's it called? What's the stuff from Wakanda?
Oh, the... Vibranium.
Vibranium. The geezer who wants vibranium. It's kind of that...
The one who said Wakanda forever.
Yeah! That's so cringy, man.
She's like, that makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Which is kind of interesting to see, like... They've really tried to show their world is embraced Wakanda. Kind of, and their culture. So that's quite interesting.
If it is that guy, that would fucking suck.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think they're honing in on him so much that it can't possibly be him. And then the guy she slept with, who turned out to be a proper arsehole, from recording her and tricking her and making her feel shit the next day, I don't think he's the big boss. And if he is, then I don't really know what his end game is. And I don't really understand why the powers that be think that they can, I suppose because she can turn human, but I just was trying to think why they think they can get her blood over the Hulk's.
Yeah.
Doesn't really add up to me, but...
Well, they got her blood as a human, didn't they?
Did they?
Yeah, because that bloke who slept with her took some blood from her when she was Jen in bed.
Oh, did he? I must have missed that bit.
Yeah, I think it was like a, not quite a post-credits, but it was like at the end of episode 7, I think it's revealed.
Yeah. I saw he took a photo and he took the camera or whatever. But I didn't notice the blood bit. But that's interesting. That is very interesting. Sorry.
Well, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like he definitely cloned her phone, didn't he? And then I thought he...
Yeah.
I thought there was like a syringe or something. But anyway, we've got a couple of days till we find out. Breaking news, I guess. Won't be by the time. Marvel has changed the release dates of 4 of their films. So at the top of this pod, we said that Blade was likely to be delayed, and Deadpool was releasing on the 6th of September 2024. That's already changed. So Blade is now releasing in Deadpool 3 slot, September 6th, 2024. So that's a delay of almost a year. Deadpool 3 will shift to November 8th, which I think was Fantastic Four's date. Fantastic Four is now going to release on Valentine's Day 2025. And Secret Wars is being delayed till 1st of May 2026, which I think is also a delay of almost a year. So, I mean, things like Secret Wars was not a surprise to move, but why did you put a date out anyway?
Yeah, that seems very strange. Very, very strange to me.
You're setting yourself up for a fail there, aren't you? By going, yeah, we're going to have two big Avengers films in 6 months, and then, oh no, look, the second one is delayed already. But, well, we're not surprised. Just say it's coming in 2026 and then clarify it later on.
I don't get that. That's really weird. I think that's really weird they've done that, but...
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. At least it announced whilst we were recording rather than after.
So. But I guess it all... which one was we saying that was weird, that they've moved? Did I just say?
Blade, Deadpool...
Fantastic. Blade's expected, Deadpool, Strange... Secret War, I guess, makes sense, because I assume they're going to have loads of... Well, my dream is that they have all the old characters come back, i.e. Iron Man, etc. But yeah, probably won't happen. And then the other film was on this list, Fantastic Four. That's a weird one, because I swear that's done by a director who's not directing anything else. They've basically got their own... They can basically do whatever they want with it, so I feel like pushing that back doesn't really help any situation.
Did they announce who it is yet?
No, they haven't.
Oh. But I think they all have to shift to kind of keep continuity, because I presume that's the reason.
Otherwise, yeah, I guess so. I'm guessing that maybe the rumours are true and that Mr. Fantastic will be in another film somewhere then, along the way. Because essentially, I feel like if Blade's pushing back everything, then that means that Blade is canonically important to the films.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, why would you move everything in line with it? And I guess Blade does connect to Eternals, doesn't it? And then I think someone the other day accidentally leaked that Eternals 2 is coming out.
Okay.
The small gentleman from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., can't remember his name. Anyway, yeah.
That's what you mean. But Blade is now coming out after at least two MCU films that it would have preceded. So we'll see how much it fits in. But yeah. Anything else? Any more? Anything else you wanted to mention?
Trying to think what else I've watched. Well, probably not too much interest for yourself. But there's an anime I watch, and it's... It was part of the big three back in the day. The big three being Bleach, One Piece, Naruto. The biggest selling animes of the time. And Bleach has a whole another arc in its manga collection called the... Oh, I'm going to butcher it. Is it the Thousand Year Blood War? Something like that. And basically they stopped. And they haven't released anything for many a year in relation to Bleach. But they released their first episode of the new arc day before yesterday, this week, and Disney have the rights to it. So Disney are actually episode by episode putting it onto their streaming platform. So I got to watch the first episode of the new season of that yesterday.
Oh, nice.
Visuals were great. They're only 23 minute episodes, so it's quick, but great visuals. It's only in subbed, so if you don't like watching things in subbed, I wouldn't recommend it, but it was really good opener. From what I've read of the manga, it stayed very true to the manga and how it's represented, so it was good starter. But yeah, to the anime fans out there, so it's a very good series to watch, and I'm sure many people will be happy to see it come to fruition, but I'm sure it'll be many years before this arc is finished, so, yeah.
Well, we haven't had anime chat in ages. You, Joe, and Obi used to talk
about it. Well, me, Obi, and Joe, no. Did Obi watch it? Can't remember, I think Obi was busy. Me and Joe watched Dragon Ball Super Superhero Movie at the cinema not too long ago. probably 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. Wasn't my favourite movie of the Dragon Ball franchise. It was very fan... what's the word? It was fan service. Very fan service. It gave characters that we haven't seen have a new form, get a new form. However, the form names might have been a bit basic, aka Piccolo turned big and orange, and they named it Orange Piccolo. Wasn't very inventive. And they brought back the Red Ribbon Army, which was a villain from the Dragon Ball series, because obviously we've gone from Dragon Ball to Dragon Ball Z to Dragon Ball GT, which I think Dragon Ball GT then was named not canon, and then they brought Dragon Ball Super out. They gave a character called Gohan a new form, and it was kind of fan servicey because they gave the form like this really pointy grey silvery hair, and a lot of fan made films on the internet said that like Goku's next form would have this long thick hair silvery kind of vibe. So I think they did a fan service for that. They brought back an old villain and made him stronger. And they brought back some other characters. So, although it wasn't my favourite, because I've watched most, if not all, the Dragon Ball films, and I think it's been like 14 or 15. And this, animation-wise, very good. But, like, in terms of story, it was okay. In terms of like other aspects, it was okay. But it was nice to watch, and it was nice to go to cinema, because I haven't been to cinema in a long time. But, yeah, there's plenty more anime stuff out there if us guys want to ever talk about it. But I'll stop there with it for the time being.
Well, maybe we can dedicate an episode, and maybe we can even bring Joe back if he's ever pops up.
True. I still think you guys should dedicate time to a short anime, because I know Obi was saying that he's watching a football one at the moment. That's a thing I'm watching at the moment, but I haven't really delved into it. Is the two things actually, the Wrexham documentary.
Oh yeah.
I really think you should watch that. I think you find that really interesting.
I'm up to date with it.
Are you? Oh shit, you're one ahead of me then.
Where are you?
I'm one before last episode, so I'm at the point where they've just brought in the second. They've just finished the second transfer window, and they brought in that other guy. And he's working really well with what's his face up top.
Paul Mullen.
Yeah, and they're doing really well.
I like the different format to the All or Nothings. The All or Nothings is very much like you can kind of there's an agenda. Like the Arsenal one was very pro Arteta, the Tottenham one was very pro Mourinho, and you do get some background access, but you can tell it's kind of been crafted in a certain way. Whereas the Wrexham one is like Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds being like, oh my God, we've got a football club. What do we do? And probably like if you or I are ever in the financial position to buy a low league club, we'd be like, what do we do? You know, there's like a kind of refreshing honesty to it. They admit that they weren't super keen on football beforehand. They saw it as an opportunity. You know, they're still figuring things out. Like they talk to the fans, who some of them want the manager out, and some of them think this player's shit or whatever. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. What sticks out to you about it?
Yeah, I think I agree with you. The format, because I tried to watch the Arsenal one, but I think for me it has to either be something that I don't know anything about, or it has to be something that I like really like. So for example, Tottenham, I was interested in it. There was boring parts, but I was interested in it. And like for example, the original All or Nothing, really interesting that. After two or three seasons, it got a bit samey and a bit boring for me. I didn't really want to watch it anymore. And, like, there's things like, for example, the basketball one that was based about Michael Jordan. Cannot remember the life of me what it's called.
The Last Dance.
The Last Dance, great thing. But this is just, it's different dynamic, because I feel like, how do I put it? Like, we're seeing it from their perspective, and it's kind of like two lost souls going into something they don't know much about. And they're smart. Like, although Rob McElhenney is, or how you pronounce his surname, is on Always Sunny and perceives to be this really stupid guy, he's actually, like, knows a lot about business by what it seems. And like the way he's just, he's in my mind, he's tactically chosen a team in this league because he knows it's financially accessible. Because a lot of people are like, oh, they're rich, why don't they go for like a bigger team? Well, let's perspective, let's put this in perspective. Like Chelsea Football Club costs £4 billion, right? Who has 4 billion to just spend? Like, they have to get a consortium together to buy it. And they got, now they've got some geezer who don't really know how to run a football club. And he's just trying to wing it and add all these changes, like hear him talk about like, all-star games. So although that's interesting, like I think they bring a perspective where they've gone in low to try and build themselves up. Obviously, I like the aspect where they try and, because it's obviously for an American audience, they do the American, the Welsh, the English. I think that's fascinating. Yep. I like how they go to community, talk to community. I think it's interesting to hear the guy from the pub. I think, although one of the football fans sounded proper depressed, it is actually interesting to see the in football fans' perspective and the community. You hear a bit of history from Wrexham that I didn't know about before. And then the big part for me is the cost of it all. Like, yeah. I knew it was costly, but I didn't know it was maybe that costly. I play FM, and obviously you can do money and everything and do wages and stuff on there, but the fact it cost them, what, £1 million a year to run the club?
Yeah.
And are they said it as you lose £1 million a year? I'm pretty sure I heard it like that, right? Or is it?
Because they're presumably they're not making enough revenue to
combat that, right? Yeah.
Break even.
Yeah, and like obviously for them, they bought Paul Mullins on, I assume, a much higher. By the way, the other players were talking about it, which I was very surprised the players allowed them to put that in the documentary. But it sounds like Paul Mullins is getting big money compared to them lot. They've obviously got the manager in, who, for his point of view, is probably thinking, damn, this is a lot harder than I thought it would be. Yeah. Then obviously the pitch, when they had to relay the pitch like 3 times, it cost them £300K. That is insane. Insane. They only bought the club for like £4 million. That's like a 12th of their, like, no, 12th? Yeah, that's like a 12th of their budget that they cost for the club. Then there's like talk about, oh, they've done it, haven't they? They bought the, it really confused me at one point when they were talking about the race course. I was like, are they buying the race course next door? But the ground's called it, isn't it?
Yeah, so they didn't buy the ground when they bought the club because it was owned by a local university or something. And so now they've bought
it. Rogue. And then they're building a new stand, which I assume costs money.
Yeah.
Obviously,
they spent £300K on Ollie Palmer.
Yeah, this is it, man. Like, money that's unheard of in the, was it the National League they're in?
Yeah.
Or then South?
No, National League.
National League. Like, that is crazy money. And, like, obviously then, but then there's an upside for, like, Ryan Reynolds, because he's got his sponsorship of his gin on there. He's got his telecoms company on there. They get, obviously, they get movie money. They get the other businesses they both have a control of. They've been sponsored by TikTok. Like, they get there now on FIFA. Like, it's just, it is fascinating. Like, I never thought, because obviously when you see the bigger clubs, you delve into like their tactical awareness and yeah, the in and outs of the transfers. But that, to see it from the bottom up is kind of interesting. Like, because I think unless they pump another million, I think they're going to really still like struggle to like absolutely dominate this division and then make themselves go up. And it's quite interesting to see how they have to come about it. Because obviously, like, I couldn't tell as well if the rich geezer who was the CEO, I think he was CEO, is bitter about the sale. Because in one episode, he sounded proper bitter. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, like.
Nah. And like, but then he then starts showing him around town and stuff like that. So I was like, is he bitter or is he not? I don't really know. Then obviously, I thought that one of the most fascinating points from, I think, the last episode was, the lady who was just saying, oh, yeah, the staff aren't treated very nicely. The new CEO isn't very good. It's like, whoa. Like, that's such a...
Yeah, the ginger lady.
Yeah, I was like, so outlandish to put that perspective in there, considering like all the good rapport you've got from everyone else. Like, that is such a...
But to their credit, like, Rob and Ryan seem to be very much like, we want to know the good and the bad.
Yeah.
But they seem quite shrewd, and like, this is a very candid documentary. Like you said, it goes into the finances. I find it fascinating on how they're leveraging all of these big companies. Like, TikTok would never sponsor Wrexham if Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney weren't there. You know, they're kind of really showing at how star power can work. But, I mean, you're right. They bought low because I don't think there's any financial fair play in the National League, so they can kind of spend whatever they want. But they chose probably the most difficult league to get out of, because there's only one team that goes up automatically and you have to win the league. And I mean, I've been following their fixtures this season.
Mate, like, you see the last game?
7-5, yeah.
But their defence is weak.
they're second, and they finished second, I think, last season, and they didn't go up. So, yeah, you know, crazy. If they don't go up again this year, they might be really fucked.
Well, I don't think they'll be fucked, but it's my perspective of it is, how long will Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney be happy to pump money into the club? Because obviously, at the end of the day, they've promised a lot to these people. Whether they go up or not, they've promised a change to the club. Now, how many people are going to buy that club off them and keep the club running at a good pace like they are? Not many people.
Yeah.
And then, but then I would argue, yeah, how long will they keep funding it? Because, what is it, four teams get relegated from League Two?
Each year?
Two? That can't be right, because two get promoted two get promoted from international, right, sorry. It's this league that get four relegated, isn't it? Is it?
Yeah.
Because two go into the south and north, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, so this is the league that's a bit more difficult. Okay, so that's not so bad, but like, obviously, when they get promoted, they've got to stick to FPP, but then they get parachute payments, don't they, I assume, and stuff. And then they get
parachute payments. Well, they get solidarity payments, but they won't be very much in League Two.
Well, and then they'll also get the split, because what they were saying, didn't they say that they don't get a split of profits or TV money down in the National League? But when you get to League Two, you do, don't you? You start getting a split of the league money and...
that's the solidarity payments. They won't get parachute payments, because you only get that if you get relegated from the Premier League.
But don't you get... But
the solidarity payments is like...
I thought when a Championship team gets promoted, they get payment. They get a big lump sum to contribute towards the increase in wages, don't they?
Championship clubs do, yeah, but not a National League into a League 2.
Oh, no, okay, right. I thought they might get that because they're going into a bigger league. And then have they even classed themselves as professional?
Yes.
They have, okay.
They are. Yeah. It's odd because the Premier League is technically separate, and then you've got Championship, League One, League Two at EFL. So they're a separate body. And I think it was only part of the Premier League formation was the agreement to these parachute payments to the Championship clubs. But what happens is, like, the rest of the TV money and stuff, small bits of it trickle down into League Two. But I mean, if they don't go up this year, you've got to think, like you said, are they going to pump more money into it? Maybe, maybe not. But also, are your Paul Mullins and your Ollie Palmers going to want to stay at that level? Because they're hitting like 30 odd goals a season. They both could be playing at least League One level. So if they go, then you've either got to be like, right, well, we're not going to pump money into to kind of get promoted straight away. Maybe we need to just try and go a bit slower. But yeah, I hope they go up. They're not my second team or anything, but I have like a small affinity for them now because I like the way they've done the documentary. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how many more episodes there are of it, but yes, it's done well. Although obviously we know what happens at the end of the season, but I wonder if they'll do a second one. It's obviously increased the exposure of it quite well.
I think it's really good actually. I don't know how to explain what like I really like about this, but I just think it's a very good. I think it's a well done documentary. I'm not sure I like the Sports Center episode, but I guess it was an interesting twist, American twist, I guess as well.
Yeah, they're trying different things.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, on that note, we'll end the pod for today. Thank you for anyone who's listening. You can check us out on social media. We're on Twitter at YSCPodcast17. And we're on Instagram as Your Average Critics, where you can also find reviews of the latest films. So we've got stuff up on there about Amsterdam, Smile, and other latest releases. Tune in next time, where I'm sure we'll cover more of the TV stuff we spoke about today, and maybe we'll talk about some of the films. I know Halloween Ends is coming out on Friday, so I will definitely try and
see. Happy days.
I will do OBs.
Alright, peace.
Keep it sexy.